Welcome to the debate, different perspectives on the federal news update for Thursday, September 18th, 2025. Today, we're diving deep into the actions of the United States federal government on September 17th and 18th, 2025. Our source material suggests these reveal a government operating with a pretty clear, unified strategic direction. Now, this period is framed as a significant push for, well, a nationalist populist agenda. But it's also meeting some substantial institutional resistance and, frankly, economic headwinds. So the central question before us today is really how to interpret these coordinated executive actions and the responses, which are multifaceted from the legislative and judicial branches. Should we see them as, you know, decisive leadership essential for strengthening the nation and its economy, or maybe as an overreach that erodes democratic institutions, undermines expertise, and creates societal friction? I'm Regan Bush, and I'll be presenting the pro-administration perspective, arguing for the necessity and effectiveness of these actions.
And I'm Carter Clinton, and I'll be representing what you might call the dissenting radical left perspective. I'm prepared to unpack these events from a very different angle, and I believe a more critical one than my colleague. I see this not as strength, Regan, but as a concerning pattern of systemic dismantling.
Right. Well, the events of September 17th and 18th, 2025, in my view, they unequivocally demonstrate an administration that's deeply committed to implementing a transformative agenda, an agenda aimed squarely at national strength and prosperity. Just consider the Federal Trade Commission's formal recommendation to repeal specific anti-competitive regulations. Now, this isn't random. It's a crucial, you could say, data-driven effort to foster free competition, dismantle unnecessary barriers for businesses, and ultimately drive innovation across sectors. And that provides a much-needed boost to our economy. Then we have the technology prosperity deal struck during President Trump's state visit to the UK. That's a clear strategic triumph. It's not merely a handshake. It's really about forging a robust Western-aligned technology bloc. And this bloc is absolutely vital for maintaining our competitive edge, especially in critical tech domains against an increasingly assertive China. It secures our future economic and strategic interests. Domestically, look at actions like the Treasury ceasing paper checks. That improves governmental efficiency, reduces fraud, modernizes operations. Simple, effective. Even the Federal Reserve's measured interest rate cut. I mean, delivered despite intense political pressure. It reflects a carefully calculated concession, sure, but one that preserved the institution's long-term independence while addressing immediate economic concerns. That demonstrates responsible governance under, frankly, challenging circumstances. This is an administration delivering on its promises, prioritizing the well-being, the economic vitality, and the security of the American people with a clear and consistent vision.
I have to say, I come at it from a fundamentally different way. What we actually witnessed on September 17th and 18th, 2025, was not decisive leadership. It was a deeply concerning pattern of executive overreach and a concerted political interference that actively undermines the very foundations of our democratic institutions, our social contract, even. The FTC's deregulatory agenda, for instance, it's not merely about reducing burdens, as you put it. It's a systematic deconstruction of the administrative state itself, that vast network of federal agencies responsible for implementing policy, often seen as a crucial check on unchecked executive power. This agenda, well, it's dismantling crucial consumer, environmental, safety, and social equity protections under a very thin guise of efficiency. Furthermore, the coordinated announcements from USCIS and the State Department implementing a significantly more rigorous naturalization test and rescinding non-immigrant visa interview waivers, this represents a deliberate multi-agency strategy to restrict legal immigration. They're using a labyrinth of procedural barriers. It's a profound display of bureaucratic cruelty, frankly, designed to exclude rather than integrate. And perhaps most egregious is the clear war on expertise, evidenced starkly by the Justice Department's removal of a research report on far-right violence, a report that directly contradicted the administration's preferred narrative. This is mirrored by those explosive accusations of political interference in public health science, leveled against a sitting cabinet secretary during a Senate Help Committee hearing, where former CDC officials alleged politicization, a stripping of independence. These aren't isolated incidents, Regan. They're coordinated attacks on objective fact and institutional integrity.
Carter, I understand the concerns you're raising. I do, but I think we need to frame the deregulatory push, particularly from the FTC, differently. It's not a deconstruction, it's more of a recalibration. The administration is targeting rules that, in their view, entrench incumbent firms, raising costs for new entrants and discouraging innovative new ways to serve customers. Now, when we talk about unleashing market forces, we're talking about removing bureaucratic red tape that genuinely stifles growth, allowing businesses, especially smaller ones, to thrive. And this directly benefits consumers through increased competition and ultimately lower prices. My perspective is that this is about fostering economic dynamism and reducing unnecessary burdens on American businesses, not some broad attack on essential protections. Are you suggesting that every single regulation, regardless of its impact on competition and innovation, should remain untouched? Is that the stance?
No, absolutely not every single regulation. But I'm sorry, I just don't buy the narrative that these are merely unnecessary regulations or simply red tape. Let me tell you why. These are often vital protections with specific social and economic goals baked in. We're not just talking about abstract market forces here. The source material highlights specific examples, Regan, like the Department of Transportation rules giving preference to businesses owned by socially and economically disadvantaged individuals, or proposed Consumer Product Safety Commission regulations mandating finger detection safety technology on table saws. Now, framing these as simply anti-competitive to be eliminated, that's an ideologically driven attack on social equity and worker safety. It's not genuine market improvement. It is a clear prioritization of corporate profit over public welfare. And, let's be honest, an overt effort to dismantle the regulatory framework of the previous administration for purely political reasons. It's an intentional deconstruction of the mechanisms designed to ensure fairness and safety, plain and simple. It's not some nuanced recalibration.
But isn't there a point where, you know, well-intentioned regulations become cumbersome, where they create bottlenecks that actually harm the very people they're designed to help by stifling economic opportunity, by reducing these regulatory burdens, especially for small businesses, we're allowing them to invest more in growth, in innovation, job creation, which ultimately leads to broader prosperity. We can ensure safety and equity through more efficient, less restrictive means. The emphasis here is on achieving desired outcomes without the suffocating bureaucracy. Can we not agree that some regulations become outdated or overbearing, and that a review and reduction is actually a healthy part of a dynamic economy?
While a review of regulations can be healthy, sure, what we're seeing here is not a targeted optimization. It's a broad stroke, ideological assault on the administrative state itself, regardless of the demonstrated benefits of these specific regulations you just mentioned. You talked about more efficient means, but where's the evidence for these alternatives? What we observe is simply elimination. And the consequences are very real for disadvantaged individuals losing a competitive edge or workers facing increased risks because safety mandates are removed. The rhetoric of unleashing market forces often masks a deliberate shift of risk and burden from corporations onto the public and individual citizens. This really is a fundamental disagreement about the role of government. Is it just to facilitate unbridled corporate activity, or is it to safeguard its citizens and ensure a level playing field?
The administration's actions, I think, clearly lean towards the former, often at the expense of the latter.
Okay, changing gears slightly, let's consider the administration's approach to immigration. The changes to naturalization tests by USCIS and the State Department's revised visa waiver policy? Look, these are necessary steps to ensure national security and uphold the integrity of our immigration system. These measures are designed to raise the standards for entry and citizenship, making sure that those who come to our country are prepared to contribute and assimilate effectively into American society. And the Supreme Court's decision to stay a lower court injunction on immigration enforcement in Los Angeles, that also significantly validates the administration's authority in these critical areas. It ensures immigration officers can perform their duties effectively without, you know, undue judicial interference. This is about maintaining sovereignty and order.
I find that argument deeply problematic, Regan.
You talk about national security and integrity, but have you considered the blatant cruelty and, frankly, the overreach inherent in these policies? This isn't about genuinely raising standards in some constructive way. It's a coordinated multi-agency strategy to tighten immigration controls. It makes it demonstrably harder for individuals to legally enter and become citizens, requiring children under 14 and adults over 79 to attend in-person visa interviews, making the naturalization civics test substantially more difficult. These actions reveal an intent to raise procedural barriers, not to genuinely assess qualifications or ensure security. They are designed to deter, to create obstacles that disproportionately impact vulnerable populations. And while the Supreme Court did act on enforcement, that doesn't negate the strong rebuke from District Judge Timothy J. Kelly, a Trump appointee, mind you, who blocked the deportation of unaccompanied migrant children to Guatemala. He found, and I quote, "no evidence that the parents of these children sought their return," and gave significant weight to whistleblower accounts of abuse and trafficking. This isn't just policy, it's an indefensible targeting of vulnerable children. These actions reflect a profound disregard for human dignity and due process.
Well, while concerns for vulnerability are always important, and we acknowledge that, the administration is focused on upholding the rule of law and ensuring a legal and orderly process. The Supreme Court's action, as Justice Kavanaugh highlighted, indicated the government has a fair prospect of reversal on the merits. That suggests the administration's position on enforcement is legally sound and within its executive authority. The enhanced civics test, it's about ensuring prospective citizens truly understand the principles and history of this nation, promoting better integration, not exclusion. And the in-person interviews, while perhaps inconvenient for some, are a vital security measure. How do we ensure national security if we allow individuals to enter or naturalize without thorough vetting, particularly in today's complex global environment?
With respect, Regan, conflating inconvenience with deliberate obstruction is a false equivalence. These procedural hurdles are not primarily about thorough vetting for national security. They are designed to be prohibitive. The implication that current naturalization processes don't ensure an understanding of American principles is simply unsupported by the evidence of past success. These changes are about shrinking the pathways to legal immigration and citizenship, period. And Judge Kelly's ruling wasn't just about some legal technicality. It was about the fundamental human rights of unaccompanied children. And it speaks to a systemic pattern of dehumanization within the administration's immigration apparatus. This is not about upholding the rule of law. It's about weaponizing bureaucracy to achieve a political outcome, one that actively seeks to reduce immigration regardless of individual circumstances or existing legal frameworks. The Supreme Court's stay simply means the legal battle continues. It doesn't mean the administration's actions are ethically or morally validated in any way.
All right, let's shift our focus again to institutional independence and political interference, a point you raised earlier quite strongly. The Federal Reserve's decision to cut interest rates, made under, yes, intense political pressure, ultimately demonstrated its institutional independence, in my view. Despite the president's relentless public criticism, calls for more aggressive cuts, the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, emerged with a nearly unanimous voice for a modest cut. There was only one dissent, notably from a newly confirmed Trump appointee who wanted a more aggressive cut. As former Fed economist Claudia Sahm noted, and I think this is key, the institution is under attack. This was not the time for three dissents. That indicates a deliberate act of self-preservation of unity against external political pressure. This isn't weakness. It shows that independent institutions can stand firm even under direct assault and make a strategic move to protect their most crucial asset, perceived independence.
I'm just not convinced by that line of reasoning. Because portraying the Fed's action as simply preserving its independence while yielding to any pressure, even slightly, that sets a dangerous precedent. The administration's unprecedented attempt to remove a sitting Fed governor created an environment where the Fed, frankly, had to make a tactical concession. Your own source notes this. They had to address the slowing economy while strategically protecting its independence. This implies they acted, at least partially, due to that pressure, rather than solely on objective economic data. But let's be frank here. The true, far more egregious affront to institutional integrity comes from the Justice Department's removal of that crucial research study. the one concluding that far-right extremists have committed far more ideologically motivated homicides than far-left or radical Islamist extremists.
This suppression of factual data directly contradicts the administration's narrative post-Charlie Kirk assassination, which focused heavily on other threats. It creates a strong perception of political interference and profoundly undermines the DOJ's credibility.
Okay, look, the Fed's action was a complex calibration. It was a sophisticated response to a multifaceted situation that included both economic indicators and the imperative to safeguard its long-term autonomy. It's really a testament to its resilience, not a capitulation. Regarding the DOJ report, the administration's position is that data must be thoroughly vetted and align with broader national security priorities. There can be legitimate disagreements on methodology or the scope of certain reports. The department has the prerogative to ensure that published analyses are robust and serve the public interest without being perceived as biased. The idea that any report contradicting a narrative is immediately suppressed is a very strong accusation, Carter, that needs more than just a perceived inconsistency.
A strong accusation, yes, and one that is deeply warranted here. This isn't about legitimate disagreements on methodology. This is about facts that directly, inconveniently contradicted a politically motivated narrative. The perception of interference, particularly given the timing and the administration's vocal emphasis on specific threats, is unavoidable and devastating to the DOJ's credibility as a politically independent body. And let's not forget the war on expertise extends directly into public health. Those accusations against HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. during the Senate Help Committee hearing, where former CDC officials allege he politicized its processes and stripped leaders of independence, that represents a direct and dangerous assault on the integrity of public health science. This goes way beyond policy disagreements. It implies a deliberate effort to subordinate scientific objectivity to political expediency across multiple agencies.
How can we possibly trust government institutions if their data and scientific processes are openly manipulated to fit a predetermined agenda?
Those accusations against the HHS secretary are, for now, exactly that. Accusations. Secretary Kennedy Jr. has maintained that his actions are aimed at streamlining public health responses, ensuring that resources are deployed efficiently, cutting through what he perceives as bureaucratic inertia that may have hindered effective responses in the past. There is a legitimate debate to be had about the balance between scientific autonomy and executive oversight in large government agencies, especially during times of crisis. The administration is seeking to ensure accountability and responsiveness. Now, that can be interpreted by some as interference, I grant you, but by others as necessary reform. It's a clash of different approaches to governance, not necessarily an undermining of expertise itself, but perhaps a reevaluation of its application within the executive branch.
To characterize these as mere accusations or a clash of different approaches really dismisses the very serious nature of former CDC officials stepping forward with specific, detailed allegations of politicization. This isn't just about efficiency, Reagan. It's about the integrity of scientific data and the autonomy of public health institutions to provide objective guidance free from political pressure. When the administration controls the narrative by removing inconvenient facts from the Justice Department and politicizing public health science at HHS, it creates a crisis of trust. This isn't some abstract reevaluation of application. It's a direct challenge to the fundamental principle that policy should be informed by objective, unvarnished expertise, not dictated by political convenience. This deeply undermines the fabric of transparent governance.
Okay, turning now to foreign policy. The technology prosperity deal with the United Kingdom is a clear win in my view. It cements our role as first partners in science and technology and forms a critical Western-aligned bloc against China. President Trump's transactional foreign policy, though, yes, often unconventional in its presentation, is fundamentally pragmatic and, I'd argue, effective. His remarks on Russia and Ukraine, for instance, conditioning further U.S. action on European countries ceasing consumption of Russian oil, or his aim to get it back, referring to Bagram Air Base near China, that demonstrates a laser focus on strategic leverage and securing tangible benefits for American interests in this era of great power competition. This is about putting America first on the global stage and getting concrete results, like the reported $150 billion in new U.S. investment in the U.K., rather than adhering to, you know, abstract ideals of alliance for alliance's sake.
That's a compelling argument for a certain type of foreign policy, perhaps. But have you considered how this transactional and often unilateral foreign policy doctrine inherently undermines global stability and alienates key allies? President Trump's conditioning of support for Ukraine on economic actions by European nations fundamentally betrays the very concept of collective security and alliances. It's a quid pro quo approach that weakens rather than strengthens our collective resolve against aggression. Furthermore, his public disagreement with Prime Minister Starmer over the UK's recognition of a Palestinian state, it reveals a dismissive approach to complex diplomatic solutions. He reduces them to single, high-stakes objectives, like immediate hostage returns, rather than engaging in a comprehensive peace plan that addresses the root causes of conflict. This approach views allies through an incredibly narrow lens of immediate economic and military utility, not shared values or long-term strategic partnership. It risks isolating the U.S. while fostering greater instability globally. It's an approach that prioritizes quick deals over patient diplomacy, creating fragmentation, not true enduring alliances.
But isn't the essence of diplomacy at some level rooted in leverage and mutual benefit? The administration is simply being explicit about the reciprocal nature of alliances. Why should the U.S. bear a disproportionate burden in global security while other allies benefit without contributing fully? Conditioning support, as with Ukraine, isn't betrayal. It's a forceful push for burden sharing and accountability, ensuring that all partners are equally invested. And regarding the Middle East, sometimes a direct, results-oriented approach, focusing on tangible outcomes like hostage returns, is precisely what's needed to cut through decades of stalled, overly complex diplomatic solutions that have yielded very little. This directness, while perhaps jarring the traditionalists, has proven effective in achieving specific, critical objectives in other areas.
I would strongly argue that true alliances are built on shared values and long-term commitments, not merely transactional quid pro quos that can be revoked on a whim. This forceful push you describe often alienates and destabilizes rather than unites. When allies feel they're being treated as subcontractors rather than equal partners, it incentivizes them to look elsewhere or prioritize their own narrow interests, ultimately diminishing the collective strength of any Western bloc. And the idea that a direct, results-oriented approach is universally superior to patient multilateral diplomacy completely ignores the immense complexity of global issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Sustainable solutions there require nuanced understanding and trust building, not just immediate transactional gains. Reducing these intractable problems to single objectives risks exacerbating underlying tensions and creating lasting resentment, which is exactly what we are seeing. It's a foreign policy that often sacrifices long-term global leadership for short-term, often illusory gains, leaving a dangerous vacuum for other, less benign actors to fill.
Well, the period of September 17th and 18th, 2025, offers, I believe, a clear illustration of a government operating with a defined, unified strategic direction. While such a transformative agenda inevitably faces institutional resistance and, yes, intense scrutiny, the administration's actions demonstrate a consistent commitment to deregulation for economic growth, assertive immigration policies for national security, and a focused, results-oriented foreign policy aimed squarely at securing American interests. Our discussions today highlight that this approach, though certainly challenged from various angles, is driven by a clear and coherent vision for national strength and prosperity, successfully navigating complex economic and geopolitical landscapes to deliver on its mandate.
What these 2 days truly illuminate, however, from my perspective, is a powerful executive branch aggressively pursuing a nationalist populist agenda that fundamentally clashes with established institutional checks and balances. We've seen a systematic deconstruction of the administrative state,
a hardening of immigration policy through deliberately burdensome procedural barriers and deeply concerning instances of political interference in scientific and law enforcement agencies that undeniably undermine public trust and the very rule of law itself. The fervent debates around these actions, like ours today, underscore the profound fissures within our governance and the urgent need to protect democratic norms and the integrity of expertise itself, which I believe are under unprecedented assault.
Both perspectives presented today certainly revealed the depth and complexity of the issues at play within our federal government, highlighting the significant tension between an assertive executive and established institutional frameworks. It leaves listeners to form their own conclusions about the path forward.
And there is certainly much more to explore in the material about these critical events and, indeed, their long-term implications for the future of governance and the crucial role of expertise in a democratic society.